right, you may proceed.
Good morning. May I please report, my name is John Keith. With me at council table is my partner, Laurie Kirkland. We represent Edward L. Hamm, Jr., the appellant. Mr. Hamm's mother and her sister, Melba Clark, each inherited a half of their mother's property in Fairfax County. And in 1989, Ms. Hamm conveyed her one half to her sister and her sole and separate equitable estate. The deed contained all caps reverter language. Ms. Hamm died in 2004. Ms. Clark died 8 years later in 2012, intestate. And at her death, her son, Reginald Wayne Clark, inherited a 1/7 interest in the property. The case was tried on stipulated facts. And the court held that the possibility of reverter was void as a matter of law. The only articulated reason for this ruling was that it was a fee simple at the time of her death.
Well, it was a fee simple subject to reverter, which makes it less than a fee simple.
I was quoting from the judge's ruling.
Oh, well, I'm sure you'll use what I just said.
Thank you.
Well, there's a telegraph.
There is no question that a grantor may retain for herself the possibility that property conveyed may revert back to her upon the happening of some event. And part of studying this case is to have to study the Copenhaver case, which is a textbook on reverters. And Copenhaver teaches that possibilities of reverter come in two types. A base fee, in which the reversion will occur upon a contingency, and that sometimes that's called a fee determinable. And the second is a fee simple limited upon a condition subsequent, which I submit is what we have in this case. Sometimes the descriptions of these two in the case law get a little muddled and a little mixed up, and often fee simple, as Your Honor mentions, is fee simple absolute is not said, and we have actually a fee simple upon a condition subsequent. The major difference between the two types of reverters is that the second variety, the condition subsequent, requires reentry. And reentry simply means that you have to assert your claim, which Mr. Hamm did in the bringing his counterclaim, and he thereby, and it's stated in paragraphs 20 and 21 of the counterclaim, that he specifically exercises his right to reenter.
May I interrupt you, Mr. Keith? In Copenhaver, the court points out that, of course, real property law is a holdover from English common law, principally, and absent statutory changes, we still apply English common law. My understanding of English common law is that unless a possibility of reverter rises to the level of a unreasonable restraint on alienation, then it clearly is within the property owner's freedom of contract and freedom of transference and freedom of rights and liberties related to property to have one. And it appears, at least the restatement describes it this way, that the way to regulate that is look at the duration of time, whether there's an invidious class discrimination going on, whether the size of the alienated people, so one person versus 100 people. This one case poses the question of whether English common law, as adopted by Virginia, would justify the voiding of a possibility reverter limited to one person during the lifetime of that one person, where there's no invidious discrimination, and the duration and the scope is incredibly narrow. In your research, did you find anything addressing how to answer that under common law principles?
No, Your Honor, but I think it's absolutely so that the real limitation on reverters is whether it unreasonably restrains alienation. I think that's the case at common law and law as we understand it in Virginia today.
So in this situation, when Reginald passes away, this whole possibility of reverter is
disappears.
It disappears. So
it also disappears if the land were sold to someone else. It is a very limited reverter in my view.
What was behind the trial court's reasoning, as best you can tell?
I wish I knew, Mr. Justice. I think it was erroneous.
Don't you think the reason was because the deed actually talked about full right and complete authority to alienate?
Yes.
And that's what the trial judge focused on. But the reason for that language was because of dower and courtesy.
Right. I'd like to point out that this time of this deed was right when we were in the throes of that change, where the Jacob case, I believe it was, had just come out and said that you can defeat courtesy or dower by taking in your sole and separate equitable estate, and the statute hadn't changed yet, and the statute changed a few years later to abolish dower and courtesy. So this is a well-drafted deed. And it has this in there, and this was state of the art at the time to put sole and separate equitable estate in there.
Well, as I look at this record, I asked the same question that Justice Kelsey asked. What was the basis for this decision? And the only one I can see is this one, and it has an explanation.
Well, and I think that's the primary what the appellee primarily relies upon. To say that somehow or other this language in the habendum clause trumps the language of the granting clause, which we know it can't do under rule of construction. The idea that this deed conveys a fee simple absolute is erroneous. The definition of fee simple in Virginia Code 5511 says when any real estate is conveyed, devised, or granted to any person without any words of limitation, such devise, conveyance, or grant shall be construed to pass the fee simple unless a contrary intention shall appear by the will, conveyance, or grant. We have both. We have both words of limitation, and we have a contrary intention appearing in all caps in the deed. The rules of construction in Morris v. Bernard, the 1913 case, when applied to this, the facts of this case, clearly indicate that the granting clause prevails. The cases cited by the estate, many of the cases go off on the tangent of maybe joins. The maybe joins cases are simply inapposite in our view. Those are cases where a life estate is given, coupled with the absolute right to dispose of the property. The Horn Book law there is that means you have a fee simple absolute, and so any condition after that is invalid.
It seems to me the plain language of the condition, as you label it, or in the habendum clause, is directly related to her husband.
Yes.
I mean, from the beginning of the paragraph to the end of the paragraph.
If you one other way to read that habendum clause, Your Honor, is when you read it, it says it refers back to the prior description of the property, what was granted. It says to have and to hold said land. Said land refers back to the description with the condition, and then it goes down, and at the very end of it, it says. And this is the language that they grasp, is to alien, convey, encumber, or otherwise deal with or dispose of the same there isn't any question that Ms. Clark could do anything she wanted to with what she got, but she didn't get the full fee simple absolute. She was missing a piece, and she was missing that reverter piece.
Right, but the language is specific to without necessity or joinder by or with her husband.
Yes, indeed.
I mean, that is clearly, as the Chief Justice mentioned, it's all about dower and curtsy.
I agree, and that was why that provision was in the deed, and that was its sole function in our view. I'll reserve the rest of my time.
4 minutes, 20 seconds.
May it please the Court. My name is Jonathan Bromley, and I am counsel for the appellee, Charles Hazelwood, administrator for the estate of Melba Clark. The only issue presented to this trial court was the validity of a clause that attempted to impose a possibility of reverter should the grantor's nephew ever acquire or reside on, even temporarily, the estate she had conveyed. The only question answered by the trial court was, can intent trump the law? And the answer is no, it can't. In this instance, this deed is clear. Let's ignore the Hebdamden Clause for now. Let's just completely ignore it. This deed is clear that she had given her entire estate, her entire interest to her sister. She held nothing back, and we know that because if you look at the preceding sentence, she actually accepts and reserves for herself a life estate, and that you can do. But then the next paragraph, she merely imposes a condition on the property. But the deed itself gives her an entire interest, and that is an interest that she could have sold, she could have willed, she could have encumbered, she could have used any way she would have liked. And the property cases that we've cited in our brief make it clear that when you hold property, when you hold an interest in property, and you have a complete right of disposition of that property, you have the right to alienate that property, do with it what you might want to do with it, anything you want to do with it, that we consider that a fee simple absolute. So what the grantee had here, what Ms. Clark held here, was no question a fee simple absolute, and that's what Hall tells us, and that's what Rule tells us, and that's what Skinner tells us.
So you're saying that the clause which has all caps, there is expressly reserved and accepted from this conveyance, ... the life estate, and then the second paragraph, a clause that says, in all caps, the conveyance automatically reverts, that those exceptions don't exist because there was a fee simple absolute conveyance in the first page of the deed?
Ms. Hamm was permitted to reserve a life estate for herself.
Why was she not permitted to reserve and possibility of reverting?
Because what she had given to the grantee was a fee simple absolute, and the cases tell us that you may not impose any type of limitation, restriction, or condition on a fee simple absolute. So once she granted her her entire interest in the property and she gave her the complete right to dispose of that property, she couldn't impose a condition further than that. And we know that is the law today because cases like Fuller are as recent as 1950.
Where's the language that makes it clear that it was a fee simple absolute?
Well, for starters, Mr. Justice, is the fact that she held nothing back once the life estate. Again, this is a condition imposed on the land itself, not on the ability for the person to alienate or do with it what she would. But even if we look, and then when we look at that final paragraph, sure, there is dower language in there. But the fact is, it also made clear that she has the right to alienate the property and dispose of it, give it away, or do anything else that she might. And so I think that actually supports the fact that not only was she given the whole property, but she had the sole and equitable right to use that property in any way that she felt necessary. And one of those...
Isn't that, as you've heard the other justice remark, isn't that simply to protect against what ultimately was wiped away in 1991?
I couldn't tell you why that this clause was included, but I do know what the words expressed therein said. And the words expressed in that clause indicate, and again, I don't believe that it's the sole authority for her having the right to alienate the property. I think the fact that she was given the whole property and nothing was held back answers that question, but I think it supports the fact that, you know, those words expressed that she has the right to alienate this property. And once she is given that right under the case law, no further condition can follow. And again, just because we know what it's called, we're calling it here a fee simple subject to condition subsequent, just because we know what it's called doesn't make it legitimate or legal under the law. So
okay,
for example...
will you tell me how the deed should have read to make it legitimate?
I think that she could have reserved for herself a remainder interest, potentially, though I don't think, I think that would have violated the law. I think that it could have potentially been designed through a trust. But the fact is, once she does a deed grant, and once she gives, again, and looking at the cases cited by Apelli, I don't think any of them are applicable here. They all deal with determinable fees. Every one of those cases deals with a fee that's for either a period of time or limited in duration or use.
The question would be, if you wanted to do a legitimate possibility reverter, as Copenhaver describes, how would you do it from your perspective? How would you say it?
Well, Copenhaver, again, I believe deals with a limited fee. It's given to a trustee in that case for the use and enjoyment of certain beneficiaries. He does not have the right to alienate from my reading of that case.
Okay, so well, how would you write a will if you were the lawyer and you were asked to write this will and to write it correctly so that that possibility reverter, in fact, is legally effective? How would you do it?
I think that I would have to reserve specifically an interest in myself, and I would have to grant myself, though, I'm not convinced under Virginia law you can actually create a fee simple subject condition subsequent. I'm convinced that you can do a determinable fee, or fee determinable, as we see in Dowell, and as I believe we see in Copenhaver and some of the other cases cited. But none of these cases, again, I think...
Okay, we'll go to the granting clause. Go to the granting clause in the fee, and then tell us what it would have to say.
I think that it would have to make clear that there was a legitimate interest being reserved in the grantor, either monetary or economical or serving some purpose. The fact is, what she couldn't do, she would have had to restrain the actual, she would have had to give the grantee less than the total right of alienation. She would have had to say, you know, for example, like, I have the right of alienation, or my heirs will have the right of alienation. We're going to keep this interest, and this is going to stay here. But once she gave the grantee the whole property and a complete use of that property, she couldn't essentially upset the laws of intestacy. And that brings me actually to another point, and the fact is, that's what she's done here. You know, this clause might have said, hey, if you die intestate, this whole property comes back to me. Because in implication, she's named an heir at law as the person that's barred, essentially, from ever receiving an interest in this property. And so, again, my reading of the case is, just to answer your question directly, I'm not sure you can do this by deed. I'm not sure you can create a fee simple, and I believe this is a fee simple absolute subject.
So you're saying in Virginia you can't have a possibility of reverter in a deed. That's your position.
I believe you can do a possibility of reverter, absolutely. I believe you can do a determinable fee, a base fee, subject to conditions subsequent. Again, I give this land to you to use for school purposes, and when school purposes end, they come back to me. You don't have the whole interest. You don't have the right to alienate. You can use it for a school. I believe that you can go ahead and give it to somebody for a term of years. But I think I want to go back to the May versus Jones, because for most of history, at least most of time in the Commonwealth, you couldn't even give somebody a life estate and give them a power of sale without upsetting the remainder interest. And it's only when they adopted the statute in 1908 that you can now create a remainder interest to follow a life estate where there was a power of sale. And in fact, the first rendition even included regular fees as well. And the General Assembly came back and they actually said, no, we did not intend to apply these permitted remainder interest to follow any type of fee, just life estates. So I think that tells us the common law rule, again, the abhorrence against restraints and conditions that follow fee simple absolutes is still alive in effect. And we have cases, again, like Hall that came many years afterwards. I don't believe a single one of the cases cited by appellant supports the proposition that you can have a reversionary interest tied to a fee simple, unless that fee itself was limited by some duration or by some time or in some manner. This fee was given to her in totality. She had the complete right to do with it what she would. She could have willed it to her other six children. The fact is she's being barred from dying intestacy. And that you can't do. You can't give somebody property and say, but if you die intestate, it goes to these individuals or it comes back to me. It's broken the law. It's void. But I want to go to another point real quick. And the fact is, even if we were to craft an exception here, or we were to say, okay, this is permissible under Virginia law, which it's not, it would still be construed as an unreasonable restraint against alienation. The fact is, the only thing that's being promoted here is the grantor's feelings are, for lack of a better word, disdain towards a particular individual.
Well, how do you know that? how do we know the grantor didn't have a perfectly legitimate reason? I don't want to hypothesize in public what that might be, but there can be legitimate reasons why a member of the family, for conduct that was found reprehensible to the other family members, said, look, you're no longer allowed on my property or any property I deed over to my daughters, period. So we don't really know what the truth is. We can say ill will and spite, like the Arkansas case did, but we're just assuming that. And if we're wrong, we're defaming them.
In any event, whatever the reasons are, they were personal reasons.
But how do we know they weren't good personal reasons?
They could have been good personal reasons.
Then why would the law be
bad? But without even acknowledging whether they're good or bad, they were personal. They served no contractual purpose. There was, you know, they did nothing to benefit the grantor economically or her family economically in any way. In other words, the only basis for it was to promote her personal feelings, whether they're good or bad,
but it's her
long
property.
Past her death.
It's her property, right?
It was her property until
okay,
she gave
so
it away.
What policy would suggest that the court or the state should determine what she can do with her property when she deeds it?
I think we need to consider the fact that we're removing this from the chain of commerce, that we're staying in the title. I can envision a scenario, for example, you know, where let's say the grantee had sold the property to somebody else, and then 10 years later, the grantor's heirs come forward and say, ah, but there was that time when the grantee here had this Mr. Clark over for Christmas, and he stayed there for an entire week, and then he temporarily resided in the premises. Therefore, this was triggered. This property, well, nobody's going to buy this property so long as there's that type of stain on the title. So it's doing a major damage to society.
But the stain dissipates as soon as Mr. Reginald passes away. I mean, it's a limited duration.
It is limited by his life, but I don't think it's limited. I mean, I actually do not know how old Mr. Clark is, but that could be 20, 30, 40, 50 years, 60 years. And are we going to, again, we're going to permit somebody to, again, give somebody the complete right to alienate property, dispose of what she, however she may want to dispose of it, and in this case, by dying intestate, leaving it to her natural heirs.
But do you have any cases that would say the limitation on scope and duration is for a specific number of years, less than 50 or 10?
There's no hard rule from what I can tell. And again, I don't think there's any case. There is a case in Virginia that says it in dicta that it may be imposed potentially for a limited duration, but there's no case that actually has a hold it set in what is reasonable and what's not reasonable, which is probably case by case. But I do think that the court in Arkansas, they got it right. They said, listen, we're not going to allow you to tie up land merely for personal reasons, especially when you're taking it outside of commerce, and in this case, you know, basically removing it from the natural heirs. We're not just dealing with a single person's interest as being forfeited. Mr. Clark only received a 1/7 interest. 9 other people inherited the property as well. All those interests are being forfeited. These are the natural heirs of the grantee who was given the power to will it, to borrow against it, to sell it, to give it away to anyone that they may want. But the fact is, like, I mean, how do we define even temporarily reside in this property? I think that by permitting a clause like this, we're essentially opening up a Pandora's box where people can go ahead and impose clauses of any nature to really just to promote their personal reasons. I mean, whether it be restrictions from where they are from or what profession that they're involved in. I mean, where do we draw the line? I don't think we have to draw a line because I think what we have here is a clear, fee simple, absolute. Where she attempted to impose a condition. We know what she intended. We're not talking about interpretation issues. We're not talking about confusion about the meaning of the words. We're talking about a repugnancy in its application to the law. So on the one hand, you can't say it's your property, and on the other hand, say if you actually treat it like your property, it's being forfeit. And that's what the cases tell us that you cannot do. And that's, again, I mean, you couldn't even do a life estate until we had the General Assembly, the General Assembly came forward and said that you can do it. And the General Assembly has never made an exception for this type of situation. And in fact, we have a statute in Virginia that permits you to go ahead and grant a timeshare estate and impose a reverter on that timeshare estate if a whole laundry list of reasons, and I'm sorry, conditions are met. That tells us that if they don't meet those conditions, that reverter is void. Which tells me that it's in derogation of the common law, which is the common law rule that no limitations or conditions may be imposed on a fee simple, is still alive today. But when I read this deed, again, I mean, it's so clear that this person had the complete right to alienate this property. And we don't even have to look at that final clause with the dower provisions to know that she gave away the entire property. She didn't keep any sticks for herself.
But that means you have to just completely delete the paragraph that says the property hereby conveyed shall automatically revert.
And that's what the judge below did.
Right, well, that's a legal question.
Yes, it is completely illegal.
Right. There's no way you can look at this deed, as you said, and know it's fee simple absolute unless you make that legal judgment, because there's a whole paragraph that says otherwise.
It's been determined, I believe it was a fee simple absolute, but and the judge, by striking the clause, made it clear that clause was void from its onset. She didn't decide that at the death it became a fee simple absolute. She decided that when this deed was made, it was a fee simple absolute, that this clause is void, that this clause is repugnant. And it is for those reasons, again, because it was an unreasonable, in addition, also an unreasonable restraint against alienation, that the lower court got this question right, and her decision should be affirmed. Thank you, Justices.
Mr. Keith?
I don't have a lot to add. My opponent doesn't believe in possibilities of reverter, particularly not when you have a fee simple upon a condition subsequent. I would say that these are time-honored real estate concepts that go back, that are, as I said, discussed in detail in Copenhagen. And I would point out that there is a detailed statute of limitations for limitation of action for breach of condition subsequent or termination of determinable fee simple at 801.255.1. And so, really, that statute of limitations has a pretty good indication that these are viable concepts, and they, admittedly, they're not used much. The Pence case cited in our brief is an example of a condition subsequent where the grantee was required to build within a certain number of years, didn't do so, and the property reverted to the grantor. If there are any questions, I'd be happy to answer.
Can I ask you this quick question? Ms. Melba Clark, suppose she had sold it, and that person had sold it, that person had sold it, and then at some point down the line, Mr. Reginald Clark lives there for a week. Would that then trigger this clause, and then back it goes to?
It would. I believe it would run with the land, and so it. I'm not sure that I would agree that or I'm not trying to interpret it, but theoretically, yes.
Right. I mean, there's an interpretation question of what that means, occupy even temporarily, but
right.
Right. Okay. All right. Thank you.
We ask that you reverse this case and remand it for final judgment.
The court will be in recess and will reconvene at 10 minutes after 11.
All rise.